From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Saudi Arabia getting into a major diplomatic spat with Canada. And what's the latest from the war on Yemen? Why should we be paying attention to it? Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board, broadcasting to you from News Corporation headquarters in Midtown Manhattan. And I am incredibly pleased and honored to welcome very special guest today, Karen Elliott House, one of the world's foremost experts on Saudi Arabia and U.S.-Saudi relations. She's the author of a book on Saudi Arabia, a senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and the former publisher of Yes, This Newspaper. Karen, welcome to Foreign Edition.
Thank you, Mary.
So let's start with this Saudi-Canada dispute. It's really quite a remarkable break between the two countries. Saudi Arabia expelling Canada's ambassador, recalling its envoy, taking other measures, all because Canada's foreign minister called for the release of a human rights activist. Karen, why this extraordinary response?
I think they are trying to signal to the United States and others to keep your mouth shut about human rights. I was there in July. They are quietly now. There are no more big Ritz-Carlton kind of arrests, but they are quietly continuing to pick up people, quietly continuing to freeze bank accounts of different individuals, and they don't want criticism of that, because I think the Crown Prince does understand that in the U.S., if human rights were to become a really big issue with Saudi Arabia, which it hasn't under Trump, it would not be good for his desires to attract foreign investment. And so he wants to be able to do what he wants to do without criticism.
Karen,
something Trump would enjoy, but yeah, doesn't have the luxury
right
of.
Look, I think that commentators on Saudi Arabia often paint the kingdom in very black and white terms. And it's not often as clear-cut as that. Of course, the United States, other liberal democracies, would love for Saudi Arabia to become much freer, far more liberal. And Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince to whom you referred, seems to be inching the kingdom in that direction. But he also faces a kind of tough balancing act, doesn't he, with the ruling clerics that his family has shared power with, if you'll excuse the dangling preposition.
Mm-hmm. I think, and I obviously could be wrong, but he has so, I think for the time being at least, so eliminated any other centers of power. I mean, he banned the religious police from arresting people and for violating the cultural and traditional and Wahhabi view of, you know, men and women shouldn't mix, etc. I mean, they eliminated their ability to harass women, arrest people, more than 2 years ago, and there was hardly a peep.
Mm.
And he has, you know, allowed women to drive. He's allowed cinemas, which were considered sinful by the religious. I went to the movies in July just to see.
And
the afternoon movie was the only one I could get into, Incredibles 2, because the 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. showings were sold out of a new movie. I've forgotten the name of it, but, one of these kind of blood and guts terror movies. And, you know, there are men and women sitting there entering the theater just like here with big tubs of popcorn and, you know, nachos and extra large drinks. I mean, it's mind-boggling to see. And they're all sitting there laughing and, you know, talking. And I was the only non-Saudi in the theater.
So, Karen,
the theater seats 500 people. There were only about 200 there that afternoon. But, you know, all of these things are completely new in Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, the prince is very big on giving people all of the modern things, women driving, cinema. But there is no political reform. I mean, power is held by him, and I'm sure he has to pay some attention to the religious, but he has fundamentally wiped out opponents in the royal family. There are a lot of people unhappy with him, but they don't have power. And I think he has curbed the religious. You can never be sure if something goes wrong that would allow people to rally. The religious are the group that can, you know, can organize the country. But they've always been able to do that through mosques. And now there is a new there's a new app in Saudi Arabia that will monitor the sermons in mosques and allow people to rate their preacher.
It sounds like he's the best chance that Saudi Arabia has had in many generations then for liberalization and more easing, at least of some of the social constraints on Saudis, particularly women, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
However, Karen, some of the economic reforms that he's attempting seem to be backsliding a bit. I'd note the Aramco IPO, that's the state-owned energy company. They were going to do an initial public offering. That now seems to be off the table. You know, again, I go back to this tightrope. He's young, he's brash, he's a reformer. He's not entirely a liberal. There are still human rights abuses, et cetera, but he seems to be moving the country in the right direction. But what happens if that economic reform stalls?
Well, the as you say, the Aramco IPO has just kind of slipped off the table because I think they did not want to make the disclosures necessary to do the IPO. And the reason for doing the IPO was to get $100 billion by selling 5% of what the prince valued Aramco at $2
trillion,
to put into their public investment funds so he could invest in things abroad to create earnings to replace the oil revenues. So they have now found another way to do that. They are going to have Aramco buy from the public investment fund for $70 billion a large share in another Saudi company, Saudi Arabian Basic Industries Corporation, which is a petrochemicals company. So they will get $70 billion to invest. And, you know, today there is news that they are investing in Tesla. I don't know if it's true or not, but that they're investing somewhere between $1.7 and $3 billion for 3 to 5% of Tesla. So he has found another way to get money to invest. Their bigger economic issue is how do they create jobs in the country, because foreign direct investment has declined, actually. And the economy last year shrunk. This year it is growing around an expected under 2%, which would be big compared to shrinking last year. but they have got to find a way to get the economy growing and creating jobs, because the government can no longer hire all the young Saudis. So they have got a youth bulge that they have to employ, or else these young people who are his supporters are going to become unhappy over the next 5 years.
Well, and it brings us back to this Canadian-Saudi diplomatic rupture, not because it necessarily represents a massive economic threat immediately to Saudi Arabia. I think the exports, Canadian exports to Saudi, probably minuscule, single digits, if that. So it's not the volume, it's the message that it sends to other foreign investors. And that has to be a concern, particularly when the Crown Prince is looking for that FDI.
Yeah, that's why I think he's very smart, the Crown Prince. And as you say, he does clearly want to free up the remove the social constraints and modernize the economy, get it off a dependence on oil. But it seems short-sighted when you arrest all your royal relatives and a lot of businessmen and put them in the Ritz. That concerns potential foreign investors.
You mean hanging upside down from their toes in the Ritz, just to be clear, some of them.
And when you have a big spat with Canada, Canada per se is not an important partner for them. So I don't think the consequences to either Canada or Saudi Arabia are very large, which is why the Saudis can afford to do it. They can't afford that kind of spat with the U.S. But it just seems like it sends the wrong signals to worldwide investors. So I have trouble figuring out, because I don't see him as vulnerable internally now, why he does things that seem to be against his big vision 2030 reforms. It doesn't strengthen him. It doesn't help. And I can understand taking these steps if you were vulnerable internally. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's more vulnerable internally than I think, but I don't see any evidence. So all I can assume is that he the best defense is a good offense. He wants to make clear to people inside the country and outside, I am in charge here. Don't question me, and we'll all get along fine.
We're talking about Saudi Arabia, its relationship with the West, and MBS, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon as we look at science, technology, and their influence on our lives. The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. The future is closer than you think.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York City with our special guest, Karen Elliott House, joining us to talk about Saudi Arabia. And Karen, I want to turn to the southern part of Saudi Arabia, the proxy war that is going on right now in Yemen between Iran-backed Houthi militants and the Saudi U.S.-backed forces. Another big battle in this years-long civil war / proxy conflict. It's now moved to a key port city, Al-Huladiyah. It's about 600,000 people located just north of the choke point entrance to the Red Sea, across the water from Eritrea. For outside observers, they might wonder, gosh, why pay attention to Yemen? And what is Saudi Arabia's interest in this war? Why is MBS prosecuting the conflict so aggressively? What say you, Karen?
I think he does see Iran as Saudi Arabia's number one enemy. And, I mean, he told me in one of our conversations that, you know, he couldn't ignore the government, couldn't ignore the Iranian-backed Houthis moves in Yemen, because if we do, the world will say, well, as it did in Syria, you know, well, Assad has invited the Iranians. We can't do anything about it. So if it's accepted that the Iranians are in Yemen at the invitation of Houthis, well, then what can we do? And he cannot have Iranian interference in Yemen right on their border. So they have no choice, he argues, but to fight. And most Saudis accepted that, I think, in 2015-16. It's becoming a little less accepted, but every time a missile falls, a Iranian Houthi-fired missile falls near the southern border or near Riyadh, you know, Saudis say, well, I guess we have to do this. I mean, indeed, in July, some Saudis were saying, why do you think missiles fall near Riyadh? Our government has the ability to shoot them down. Why don't they, you know, why did they allow this to happen? Because the implication being they want Saudis to understand the threat. And missiles falling near Riyadh makes the threat real in a way that it doesn't when they just fall on the Saudi border in, you know, in Najran and nowhere near a big city like Riyadh. Well, I think he fears the Iranians.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you raised the missile threat to Riyadh. I get a lot of press releases from the Saudi Arabian embassy in the United States and based in Washington. They're really stepping up the public information campaign, if you may, on just how serious the threat really is to Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's like Canada shooting a missile into Washington. I mean, Americans would be up in arms. Mm-hmm. But Karen, you buried the lead here. So you've been sitting down with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. That's fascinating. What are your impressions of him? I mean, he's a young man. He's aggressive. He's got a lot of aspirations for the country. But is your impression that he is ready for this kind of sustained conflict? Mature enough for it?
He is the most self-confident Saudi I have ever met. He speaks. He's not just someone who has memorized the McKinsey presentation on how they can reform the economy. I mean, he's very articulate, self-confident, and extremely young. And I keep wondering, how does a guy, you know, this age and schooled only in Saudi Arabia, though obviously he's traveled a lot, where does he get these ideas? But I think he's very, you know, he's very engaging. You would, I've never had dinner with him, but you would love to have dinner with him. You know, he talks. I mean, but he doesn't filibuster, so you can actually engage in a, and he doesn't seem to shy away from questions. Not in my experience, but, you know, if you saw the CBS interview that he did on TV before he came to the U.S. in March, you know, she asked him, you know, something about his wealth and buying the Da Vinci painting, and he said, I'm the son of a king, the grandson of a king. I'm not Nelson Mandela or Gandhi.
He did stop by our editorial board during that visit. We had a similar impression of him. To be honest, Karen, he reminded me of descriptions of his grandfather. And you wrote a wonderful op-ed on our pages making that same comparison. You know, a really charismatic man, but also someone who's really quite brutal to his enemies. And the Yemen war, I think, highlights that. It's also an important front in the war on terror. You have al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and ISIS there. It's been a key focus of the United States' anti-terrorism efforts. So there's more at stake here, I think, too, than just the Iranian threat to Saudi interests. I mean, there's a U.S. interest in this war, too.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's a U.S. interest in curbing Iranian encroachment all over the region, and
yes. That's
the Saudi concern. It's not just, the Iranians in Yemen. It's what they consider, and it's not paranoia, the encirclement from, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, and in their minds also messing around in Bahrain when they can. And it's not in the U.S. interest to have the Iranians continue to expand. We don't seem to be doing all that much about it. I mean, I guess we're helping the Saudis some with intelligence and other things in Yemen, but we don't seem nearly as concerned about Iranian expansion as they are, or as I think we should be.
Well, I guess you're always more concerned when they're on your doorstep. That's unfortunately, we are out of time. That's it for Foreign Edition today. A big thanks to Karen Elliott House for joining the podcast. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board. I'll be back with you on Friday.